Thank you, Erica. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect them, let me begin by asking this. Well, I know that you don't want to give away the whole New Hampshire part of the story. I am curious to be able to reconstruct what someone's life was like when they're living as a fugitive, I would think presents a lot of difficulties for a researcher. And I just wonder if you might share a little bit about how you went about trying to reconstruct that part of the story.
Yeah, that is, you know, that was probably the most difficult part of writing this book. The first 23 years or 22 years of Ona's life were fairly well documented, meaning that George Washington kept fantastic records. And I could read through the slave census records at Mount Vernon. I could look through the ledger books of the house in Philadelphia and know when Ona Judge was given money for new stockings. I could piece that information together. What became more difficult was putting the fragments of her life together here in New Hampshire. Of course, as a fugitive, the one thing that became most important to her was anonymity. And so the desire to be unknown often makes it extremely difficult to pull the sort of threads of the lives, in particular of women whose names often change, right? So it's hard to sort of track them, whether they're fugitives or not. And of course, of enslaved people or fugitives, Ona Judge was not literate. We believe that she learned to read by the end of her life, but I'm not certain that she ever learned to write. Fortunately, towards the end of her life, she left 2 interviews behind in 2 abolitionist newspapers. So Ona lives a long life. She outlives the Washingtons by decades, and she actually dies in 1848 at sort of the apex or the beginnings of a really sort of radical abolitionist moment. And there are 2 newspapers, the Granite Freeman, that interview her, as well as the famed Liberator, published by William Lloyd Garrison. And her story appears on New Year's Day, in the newspaper on New Year's Day, discussing her life as an enslaved person. So she's being interviewed, and clearly it's the end of her life. And therefore, there's always a question about memory and concerns about fading memories. But she was fairly accurate, and I was able to take things from that interview that would help me sort of tease out the rest of her life in New Hampshire. And it also took just good old-fashioned kind of detective work and looking under every rock and stone. And, you know, I'll be very honest, what I've presented and never caught is the story of Ona with the information that was made available or that I was able to find. And it's my hope. You know, people say to me, well, are you worried that something's going to unearth itself that will change the story or change the narrative? And I say, not at all. That's exactly what historians dream about. Let some letter fall out of some old desk that tells me something else about Ona, and then I'll write the next edition of the book, right? But what I've presented with this book is not only a story about Ona's life as a Black woman, as a fugitive in New Hampshire, but I've also tried to give a description of what it meant to be enslaved, free, and fugitive in New Hampshire, whether you were Ona or her husband Jack Staines or eventually one of her children. Your life meant something very different according to that status as a free person, as an enslaved person. And so Ona's life gives us the perfect portal into understanding the early American Republic and seeing the beginning of the new nation through the eyes of the enslaved.
Why do you use the term enslaved person/people rather than slave?
That's a great question. I'm so glad that was the first question. I'm very sort of purposeful with that term enslaved. And I, in the book, I move back and forth for sort of sound and fit between the word slave and enslaved. But I'm very purposeful about using the term enslaved because it reminds us, it reminds the reader that this was an institution placed upon people, that this was not their identity. And when you say slave, it's like, okay, that's your identity. But to use the term enslaved reminds us that this was a status that was placed upon the lives of millions of people. And so I think it helps us to pull apart how complex slavery was at that moment, and also to remember that to use the term slave finds a sort of legal definition for a person, but tells us very little about who that person was. And it allows us to sort of forget about the lack of humanity with enslavement. So I'm very sort of purposeful about using that term, enslaved.
Considering the research on George and Martha Washington, why wasn't this story told before?
Oh, I know. That, right? That was a question that I, as I was writing this book, I was totally nervous. Like, someone's going to scoop me. Someone is totally going to write this story. Why hasn't this been written? And, you know, it's year three, year four. I'm like, okay, when's that book going to come out and beat me to it? And then I realized by year three or year four why this story hadn't been told. It was really hard to find the research on this. And I'll be very honest, when I began, I didn't know if I would have enough to write a book. Maybe it'd be an article, maybe it would be an essay. And the more I kept sort of looking and spending time in the archives, I realized, no, this woman needs a book. And in part because not only is this biography and telling us the story of an extremely courageous and amazing woman, but as I said before, it allows us entry into thinking about the founding of the nation through the eyes of the enslaved and not through the eyes of founding fathers. You know, we have a lot of that work, and it's important work, but I offer this as an alternative, perhaps as a corrective to a larger narrative about American history. So I kept asking myself that question, well, why is nobody written? When I originally began working on this, the only thing in existence about Ona, there was a young adult fiction work. And there were a couple of historians who, in their kind of voluminous work on Washington, may have mentioned Ona in a chapter or in a couple of paragraphs here or there, but no sort of full treatment of her. And so while I wondered why it hadn't happened, I was also really grateful because it gave me an opportunity to do the work.
This question, I was struck by and agree with your description of Judge as an American hero. How do we change our collective memories and narratives to see her as an American revolutionary, opposed to Washington in part, of course, but also representing an extension of revolutionary ideals?
That's a fantastic question about Ona as a revolutionary person. I think part of the reason I ground this book in the beginning of the era of the revolution, aside from her being born at this moment, right, at a moment when this nation was putting forth ideas supposedly about democracy and freedom and built this nation upon that premise, here stands Ona Judge, a direct contradiction of those ideas about life and liberty and happiness. And so having her sort of, or centering the story about the revolutionary era, but more specifically the founding of the new nation, having that story centered upon a black woman inevitably changes the narrative. You see it differently for the first time. And I think when you read Ona's story, aside from knowing how courageous or learning how courageous she was, how she negotiated or attempted to negotiate with the president, how she had enough courage to walk out and to know that she would be hunted by the most powerful family in the nation, all of that reminds us that this was an incredible woman, and her act of living as a fugitive was resistance. So when we think about those who are revolutionaries, there are those who pick up guns, there are those who pray us through revolution, there are those who write us through revolution. She lived. She survived. She resisted by her existence. And so it's her story and the stories of others who lived like Ona that constantly reminded everyone, including the people of New Hampshire, that there were deep problems with this new nation revolving around the institution of slavery, and under slavery, as long as the nation held on to slavery, it would never truly be a free democracy. So I think I was purposeful in connecting her to the era of the revolution and this new nation, because it's her existence as someone who resisted that reminds us of that time period.
Are there any descendants of Ona Judge today?
So any descendants, that makes me give away part of the book. But so what I'll say is this, there are no direct descendants of Ona, meaning coming from her husband or children. However, there are a number of people who are related to her siblings. And those men and women are in conversation with Mount Vernon in terms of defining and cementing their position as those connected to Ona Judge.
Thank you, Erica, for sharing your time and expertise with us today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at monadnocklyceum.org and stay up to date on our events by liking us on Facebook. The program next Sunday will feature Dr. Robert Weinberg addressing the question, "Are we curing cancer?" Thank you, Dr. Dunbar, for a wonderful talk. Now please join us for more time with our presenter and for some refreshments in the parish hall, which has been most generously provided by Cooper's Hill Public House in Peterborough. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank Call's Garden Center and Florists of Jaffrey for the beautiful flowers. If you have asked a question that was not answered during the program, please feel free to ask it during the reception. Thank you so much for coming today and making possible this lively dialogue. We'd like to hear from you about your experience, and we encourage you to fill out the blue card and add your name to our email list on the clipboards available. Thank you.